Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 36, Film Scoring Tales. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is Jeff Rona, film and TV composer and music tech geek. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I didn't know I was going to be called a geek or nerd in the first 5 minutes.
Hey, this show is called Home Theater Geeks, and I only have geeks on this show.
Oh, great.
And you are an uber geek, I have to say. Jeff and I have known each other for a very long time, and we have been geeks together for all of that time, starting at Cal State Northridge in the computer music department.
Oh, my. Absolutely.
You remember that, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It was the very, very earliest days of digital audio. It was a time when people trying to develop the technology were really just trying to figure out what worked and what didn't.
Right. And look how far we've come. We're going to talk a lot about that over the next hour. I want to make sure that everyone who is tuned in to the live broadcast, either in watching the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, know that they can post questions for Jeff, and I will pass on as many as I can while we have our discussion. So, Jeff, I thought I'd start with a little bit of you telling us some of the movies and TV shows that you have written music for.
Oh, sure. I got started in television in the 90s. My first television show was a show called Homicide that Barry Levinson produced and directed. And from there, I did a show called Chicago Hope. Which was a David E. Kelly show. Mm-hmm. Then I did a Ridley Scott film called White Squall. I worked on two or three other films.
I have to interrupt you here for White Squall, because I, in fact, worked on that movie as well with you. I was honored and privileged to play the seashell trumpet.
Yeah, on conch shells.
Conch shells, exactly right, which was perfectly appropriate. Yeah, the sound of the sea for White Squall, exactly right.
You know, we had an orchestra for that as well. We recorded it with the London Symphony in London, and afterwards, after we mixed it, there was this interesting contrast between the orchestra with all the horns and brass, and mm-hmm. you on conch shells, and not the director who loved it, but the editor. Every time there were these seashells, he'd say, "You know, we need to fix something at that horrible noise."
You never told me that.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I don't think it's a horrible noise. I think it's a wonderful noise.
Well, I'm sure you do. Actually, on another movie with Ridley Scott that I worked on called Black Hawk Down, I played some African flutes that were very shrill. And in mixing them, I made them even more shrill. Mm-hmm. And not the director, same director, who loved the sound, but the producer would say, "What is that horrible sound that gives me a headache? I'm going to call it the Excedrin sound." and you hear it all through the film.
It's you playing these ethnic flutes.
It's me playing these little African flutes. I think it was this one.
Right there. So play us a few
narrow,
notes.
It's narrow, so it's very shrill.
You're not going to play us a couple notes there?
No.
Nope. Okay.
So, but you know, it's interesting because there's just a whole I think on the geek side of audio, you think about fidelity and you think about accuracy and you think about how the reproduction of sound is very true to the source.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that throughout my career, it's been about creating sources that aren't necessarily true to anything.
Really? How do you mean?
Well, you know, even though I write for orchestra, like on some of the films I've said, mm-hmm. or if it's an electronic score, like I did, I co-wrote on Traffic, and then a follow-up to that, a television version of Traffic. It's not like what the goal is absolute accuracy to the sound of an orchestra or the sound of a guitar or the sound of a flute. It's about creating something emotional, and it's not about fidelity or accuracy. That's the word. Mm. In film sound, accuracy isn't the goal. Even if it's a very traditional film with a traditional score, between the time that the movie is conceived and the time that it's viewed, it passes through all of these stages, which I guess we can talk about in the next hour, that are all about achieving a goal of storytelling, mm-hmm. but not necessarily achieve the goal of accuracy.
Hmm. Why would, say, let's talk about a more traditional film that would use a standard orchestra, say, why would you not want the score, the music, to sound accurate? I understand what you're saying. You want to convey a particular emotion. Can that not be done with an accurately reproduced musical score?
In some cases it can, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike the recording of symphonic music, film scores are recorded typically in a much more pop fashion, meaning that the orchestra is often recorded in separate sections with the brass and the percussion recorded separately, so that a mix can be created that isn't necessarily true to how an orchestra would sound if it was all playing at once. Mm. But also, most modern film scores are often an amalgam of instrumentalists playing in a studio with electronic elements. So, for example, a majority of film scores are recorded with a blend between real orchestra and sampled orchestra, and the two are mixed together to create a kind of a hyper real sound. So when you hear a lot of film scores, not all of them, but when you hear a lot of film scores, you're often hearing what you're hearing, whether you're listening to it in the film or on a soundtrack album, separated from the effects and dialogue. And we should also talk about how in the final mix, the music is often dissected in a way that deals with the fact that it's being blended with dialogue and effects. But in the music itself, you're hearing an amalgam between orchestra, sampled orchestra using various technologies, electronics, synthesizers, electronic percussion, guitars that have been, you know, and then various instruments overdubbed, whether they're ethnic instruments or not. And then the way they're mixed has nothing to do with how it would sound if it was a bunch of musicians in a room.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So it's not trying to replicate the concert experience, obviously. It's trying to support the story and increase the emotional impact. And however you as the composer and the mixer and so on feel you can achieve that, that's how you're going to do it.
Exactly. And the engineers, the recording and mixing engineers whose work in film are well loved, they're people who really go in and mix the orchestra in a fashion that really more or less resembles a pop album, with EQ and compression and dynamics and effects, reverbs and delays and whatever's needed to get the orchestra to sound great, but sound great under dialogue often or under sound effects. So a traditional classical recording, an accurate high-fidelity recording of an orchestra often won't work once it's been blended in with things like dialogue and effects.
We've already got a question from the chat room, HTG 1098. Thank you for using HTG in your handle. Who's your favorite film composer? Who has inspired you?
Oh, wow. You know, I don't think there's any one composer who's really inspired me above them all, but those composers whose music really got me interested in film music to begin with would have been first Bernard Herrmann,
mm-hmm.
you know, who sort of introduced minimalism and a kind of an avant-garde into really touching scores.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Goldsmith, whose music really touched me when I was still a student. And then on into the more modern composers like John Williams or Hans Zimmer or Mark Isham or Thomas Newman and Danny Elfman.
One of my faves.
You know, some really great music being written for the film. You know,
yeah.
of the last 50 to 100 years of orchestral music, it's amazing how much of it was written for film that is just incredibly resonant.
Yeah, it's amazing, actually. Ernst Korngold wrote some film music.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall if Stravinsky. I don't know if Stravinsky did.
No, he was invited to a meeting with Louis B. Mayer from MGM,
mm-hmm.
and he was now living in Los Angeles, and of course was an icon of classical music. And there were other icons of classical music who had or were interested in writing film music. Prokofiev had written film music. Mm-hmm. Tchaikovsky had not written film music.
He was a little ahead of film. Well, maybe not much.
But Aaron Copland did a film score.
Uh-huh.
Korngold was considered a pretty serious cat. And so Stravinsky was invited to meet in Culver City about the possibility of scoring a film. And they said, Mr. Stravinsky, we love your music. We'd love to have you do a score. And he said, great, I want to do it. And they said, well, you know, we have a film ready for you. How long do you think you would need? And, you know, he just thought towards his, you know, his ballets and operas. And he said, no, I can do it in about a year. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of the meeting, and he never scored a film.
No.
Says we don't have that kind of schedule, kind of luxury.
Right. Now, you mentioned Hans Zimmer, and I wanted to get into that, into him in particular, because I know that you worked at his studio for quite a while.
Yeah. We shared a studio for 7-some years.
Mm-hmm. And am I not correct that it was sort of a film scoring workshop, if you will, with a number of composers sharing studio space with Hans?
Yeah, there were a lot of composers who came in and out of that studio while I was there. John Powell was there. Harry Gregson-Williams was there. Roy Hay from Culture Club, who had been scoring films, was there. Steve Jablonsky was there, who does the Transformer movies. Ramin Djawadi was there, who does a lot of the Friday the 13th and those films there. Klaus mm-hmm. Badelt was there.
How did working there affect your work or influence you in what you do today?
Well, you know, I think the thing that Hans Zimmer brought to the whole equation for me and a lot of other composers was how seriously he took production. You know, he came from the advertising world and he and the pop world both. So he had worked with such good record producers and recording engineers. And it's not that film music didn't sound good, but nobody took it, especially when it came to working with electronics and rhythm sections and drums and guitars and keyboards and samples. Nobody had pushed the bar as hard as he was pushing it to write music that sounded as good as it did in order to support the composition. Mm. You know, music, you know, what creates the emotional impact of music to any listener is, of course, first and foremost, the creativity of the music itself. And you can't separate it entirely in terms of, you can't separate the emotional impact from how it sounds, the actual experience of listening to and hearing the music. Mm-hmm. You know, low fidelity does impact the emotion of listening.
You know, I've
this
I've
is kind of
always...
why you talk to people about, you know, speakers that cost, you know, what a, you know, average, you know, American makes in five lifetimes.
Yeah, exactly right. And I've also often talked about how highly compressed sound, MP3s at low bit rates and so on, I believe have less emotional impact than the same music played back at higher fidelity. I've heard of studies that, that actually quantify this, although I have
I know of one directly. Actually, MIT Media Lab did a little test quite a few years ago. Excuse me. Where they set up a test environment, I think, in a shopping mall, and they invited people to come into a room. And what they said to them was that they're being shown a new large screen, you know, video screen.
Uh-huh.
And they were asked to evaluate two screens. They're asked to compare two screens and decide which one they thought looked better.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, what they did was, in the polling, one screen always was considered the better screen. But the only difference between the two screens, they were identical screens, but one had the better sound system.
Wow.
So everybody who experienced that video playback, everybody who heard it better thought they saw it better. And I think that's actually a very telling thing.
Absolutely. Wow. Wow. I'd love to get the link to that study and actually write about it. So if you can send that to me some point, that'd be great. Here's a question from the chat room. Are you surprised that the orchestra is still so prevalent in film scores? 20 years ago, would you have thought that the orchestra would still rule?
You know, it clearly, film music is in some ways remains linked to film. Film is a part of popular culture.
Sure.
And films often represent elements of popular culture in different ways. So whatever you're hearing on the radio has a way of seeping into films. Now, 20 years ago was sort of the pinnacle of the soundtrack era, meaning you had movies like Top Gun, who were best known for their songs. And for quite a few years, the creativity behind film music was pushing away from the score and pushing more towards songs because, what's the purpose of a song in a film? It's to sell tickets. And to that extent, producers were hoping to cash in on the popularity of songs on the radio. Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of that. Now that's waned a lot. But in terms of electronics versus orchestral music, two things. First of all, the orchestra has always had a place in film, although it rises and falls with experiments in other forms. So there was soundtracks for a good long while. That's much less so now. And every so often, a film will be a huge hit. And whatever that film's score was done with becomes sort of the next thing. Mm-hmm. So for a while, you had Thomas Newman, for example, who used his orchestra, but uses it either subtly or sometimes not at all. So... for a while, there were a lot of movies trying to emulate his particular approach to film music, and the orchestra started to take a back seat. Then you have a couple of Harry Potter movies come out, and suddenly the orchestra comes back as a bigger component of of what constitutes the soundtrack for popular, the sound of a popular film. So it definitely rises and falls. It doesn't surprise me that the orchestra has maintained its position in film, because, you know, as long as people still enjoy going to see movies on large screens in theaters, in other words, bigger than screens in homes, people are going to want and enjoy a larger than life experience. There's an emotional component to seeing a human face 50 feet tall versus, you know, 50 inches tall. Mm-hmm. And with that visual impact comes the need to have a sonic impact at sort of the same scale. Now, yes. Film, you know, sound in a movie theater compared to sound at home, if you have a really, you know, groovy, super cool, uber loud sound system, you can recreate the emotional impact of loud music and loud sound effects at home much easier than you can simulate the effect of a large screen. Because even if you take the sort of that parallax of a screen that's, you know, 15 feet in front of you versus, you know, 15 yards in front of you or whatever, even if it's sort of the same for your angle of vision, it's still not the same.
Why not? Still not the same. It would seem to me to be able to be the same depending on where you're sitting and how big the screen is. You can achieve that same field of view, at least with a front projector in a home theater. I'm not sure you want to sit close enough to a flat panel, a 50-inch flat panel, to achieve that same field of view.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Let's say that you were going to compare a bonsai tree sitting on your desk with the sequoias.
Mm-hmm.
At a distance.
Mm.
Now, let's say that in your field of vision, both are identical.
Mm-hmm. Would those both occupy the same space, the same degree, the same angle.
Right. Would you say that those are the same experience emotionally?
No.
So then what are you saying?
Then I'm you've just given me an example that contradicts what I just said, which is that, you know, the scale of what you're looking at can be different even if it fills the same field of view.
I think it does. I mean, look, I have a relatively decent sized television in my house and I go to the movies. And I hate it, by the way, when I go to a movie theater and I don't know if I'm going to see it on a bigger screen or a smaller screen because you pay the same and they won't tell you if that film is being projected on a bigger screen. I hate going to movie theaters and finding a screen that's small. But even the smallest screen in the multiplexes here in LA are, you know, several hundred times bigger than my TV.
Yeah, right.
but there's just no question that A, you're in a theater with other people. You know, you're feeling them. They're feeling you. A decent sized screen, our eyes aren't fooled by how far or close they are. We know that screen, we can see how many rows there are in front of us. Mm. Emotionally, we know that person in front of us is 50, 60 feet tall. And it's not like a 50-inch television or a 60-inch television 10 feet away, even if it's the same. So getting back to the question about the emotional impact of the orchestra, you know, films are all very heightened. And now if we move beyond just projectors and screens and size, forget about size being impact, movies often tell very big stories, or they tell small stories in big ways.
Mm.
And as a composer, our job is to stay in that, along that same path, which is to tell a big story in a big way or a small story in a big way, but do it very carefully. Our job is to never overwhelm the characters, never overwhelm the story, never overwhelm the dialogue, and in many cases, don't even overwhelm the sound effects. We're often sitting in the back of the bus, and yet nothing in if you close your eyes, other than, you know, the dialogue of somebody saying "I love you" or "I'm going to kill you," nothing resonates emotionally as much as the music, and often the dialogue sits kind of flat without the music. There's something unique about an orchestra that even if it's turned way down, in the mix of a soundtrack projects emotionally to the audience more than non-orchestral scores.
Hmm. So this led me to ask you. This leads me to ask you one of the questions I had in my list, which was, in general terms, how much of your scores are orchestral versus electronic?
Yeah, kind of goes up and down. I'm often the guy they call to do kind of cool, chill, ambient music, and so that requires a primarily electronic approach, although all of my electronic scores still have live musicians, whether it's a guitar or a string quartet,
percussion,
whatever, yeah. Conch shells.
And by the way, I'm still available for conch shells.
you're my first call.
All right. go ahead.
Anyway, I go back and forth, you know, between orchestral and electronic stuff. To me, I don't treat them that differently. You know, the goal is always to achieve the maximum emotional sense, whether it's with strings or with guitars. It doesn't matter.
Mm. I was going to ask something you said earlier reminded me. I wanted to ask you about this, and we've got a question from the chat room that relates. The question from Just My Two Cents says, do you think movies being made today have sound that can be appreciated in a non-optimized family room with, say, a decent 5.1 system? Or is there content where people are really missing out without a dedicated home theater, 7.1, all that stuff? And that kind of ties in with what I was going to ask, which is you mentioned emotional impact being related to loudness. And I've always complained, and much more recently even, that movie soundtracks in commercial theaters are so loud as to be painful.
They are really, really loud, and they're loud for a reason.
You think that adds to the emotional impact?
Of course. It depends on what emotion.
Well, my emotion in those cases is mostly just annoyance.
Well, you're an old fart. So am I.
True enough.
Those movies weren't made for you. No, if you go see a Jerry Bruckheimer movie, it's the equivalent of it's a roller coaster ride. It's a purely visceral and even physical experience to watch those movies. Between the editing, the speed of the editing, the speed of the dialogue, what little dialogue there is, you know, it's about, you know, it's, you know, guns and chases and breasts and
and explosions.
And explosions.
And exploding breasts, maybe.
Let's hope not. So, yeah, films have gotten louder. Actually, to the point now where they are painful. And it's for the effect. It's purely for the theatrics of loud explosions and loud everything. You know,
and you can't get that at home as much as you can in the theater.
Right. Well, theaters are in theory calibrated. So there's this 85 decibel calibration level. You know, there's zero is 85. I don't think it used to be 85. I think it's gone up. Mm-hmm. And so with Dolby and THX wanting extremely accurate reproducibility, the studios where movies are mixed, called dub stages, are calibrated at this 85 decibels being zero. But there's headroom, so you can go up above 85. You just can't stay there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's 85 dB as a kind of for consistency is loud, you know? And
it is. In fact, I think THX recently reduced their reference level for home theater, not commercial cinema, but home theater, to 75 dB.
Which, God, if you're that close to the speakers, I mean, the 85 dB, you figure for the cheap seats in the back, it's fairly, I mean, movie theaters are supposed to have a fairly good amount of dispersion so that there's no sweet spot in a movie theater, both in terms of, you know, stereo and loudness. But of course, it's louder at the screen, because that's where the speakers are.
Sure.
So even though it's highly dispersed sound, it's really loud. I mean, the first third of a theater is incredibly loud. The back third of the theater is reasonable. Hey, you know what? You should sit in the back third of the theater.
Exactly right.
Because, you know, the surrounds are on the side, not in the back. So,
well, some theaters have surrounds in the back, or they're starting
to
anyway.
A few.
We're also now starting to get a few movies with actual 7.1 mixes. Up till now, it's been almost always 5.1, but I think Toy Story 3 was the first 7.1. I was at Disney last week, and I saw clips from Tron, Tron Legacy, and Tangled, which is the Rapunzel story, and those are both being mixed in 7.1.
Mm-hmm.
Have you mixed anything in 7.1 yet?
No. My music is all delivered in 5.1, and in a particular way. In what are called stems, which is multiple 5.1.
How do you mean? Can you describe that a little bit?
Somebody's trying to call me, even though I'm on. Can I switch I can switch Do Not Disturb in Skype, and it won't cut you off, right?
I don't know. I would just ignore it.
All right. Now somebody keeps calling in. And I don't even know who they are. So anyway, I never use Skype except for this. He just called.
And then boom, people are starting to call you.
Yeah. Stems. I want to get back to the question that was asked a minute ago about whether it really causes a lessening.
Of emotional impact in the home because it's lower.
Yeah. Well, the question wasn't about the volume. It was about if you're listening on a less than optimal sound system.
Yes.
And you know. If your less than optimal sound system includes some kind of modest subwoofer, so that at least you're getting more or less the full range of sound for the film, I don't personally think it's that big a deal. I'm listening on some very modest speakers at home, and I'm very happy with my home theater experience.
What do you have at home?
I have these little bookshelf Definitive Technologies Pro Cinema 1000s in the front and Pro Cinema 800s in the back.
Definitive Technologies is a great company. Make great speakers.
They are a great company. You know, I had them on these little stands, and then I got a new console table to set my TV, and there was room for the speakers. And I'd thrown away these little tripod legs that came with
The speakers.
And I contacted the company saying, you know, I threw them away. I never thought I would need them, and now I need them. And they just ssent them to me for free the next day. The head of the company said, hey, tell me what you need. I need anything else? They were great.
Oh, man.
Fantastic. Anyway, no, I really don't think that you need a super, super expensive system to get very high quality. A good emotional experience. I think that anything reasonable. I think surround is certainly more valuable. I think listening to films at home just in stereo is definitely lessens it. I think a modest system is more than is fine. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Put it up so that it's a good volume, not too loud, and I think you're doing great. You know, anyway, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. What else have you got in your system? I'm curious about that. What's your TV?
At home, it's a Samsung rear projection DLP TV. Mm-hmm.
And you recently upgraded your receiver, and you had a good story about that. I wanted to share that with everybody.
You know, I think it's important to preface it by just saying that, you know, I live in a studio environment. I monitor on relatively high end speakers. When I'm working on a film and I'm on the dub stage, I'm in a room filled with world-class equipment in terms of speakers, amplifiers. You know, I mean, it's a theater It's a simulation of a theater experience, but I don't have a huge system at home. I just have an adequate system that does what I need to do.
Before we continue with Jeff Rona, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com, which has easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or blog. It's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts, so anyone can be up and running right away. There are hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of the designs to fit your needs. This all-inclusive service includes modules to build your website, modules of various types, a blog module, for example, which includes import and export support for WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, and Typepad. It has forum capabilities and a form builder that lets you collect email addresses and other information, a Flickr photo display, which is something I would use, certainly, a Twitter widget, which lets you display tweets on your website and in a customizable format, Google Maps, and more. Website tracking and built-in search engine optimizer, permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability, and an innovative drag-and-drop Ajax interface. Not only that, you could even log on to your website from your iPhone and update it on the go. Use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it at any time. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just try it out and build your website. If you decide to purchase, you can use the offer code HTG and get 10% off for the lifetime of your new account. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. So you were telling us the story of getting a new Denon receiver.
Yeah. You know, so all I was saying was, you know, my professional life is based in a very, very high-end, high-tech, hi-fi world. And my home theater is really simple. I don't watch a lot of TV. I don't watch too many movies at home, a few. And I've always wanted it to sound good, but also be very simple and compact. And simplicity has always been very important. I've had the same receiver for many, many years, a Denon receiver that was built like a tank and sounded great. But I realized this year that all the components in my system, except for my old Denon receiver, were all HDMI.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is, I have a Mac Mini, which now has an HDMI out, which I use for watching Netflix and for listening to music. It's sort of my music jukebox. I have thousands and thousands of songs, and you know, I have all my music on there. Anyway, so everything in my home is HDMI except for my old Denon receiver, and so I decided to get a new one. So looked on a few reviews, talked to you, my geek, and my Uber geek, if I should say, and decided that a new Denon receiver was actually probably just right, and I found a really nice one for a very modest price that was really virtually entirely HDMI. That is, the back, instead of just being, you know, a wall of little jacks, was really just these six little HDMI ports, five in, one out. And I thought, perfect. It has an iPod interface on the front. It can be remote controlled. It actually looked really, really nice. So called around, found one hi-fi store here in the area, near my studio in Santa Monica, that had in stock, and went to buy it. And the guy who I usually buy from at the store, I bought a few other things from him, wasn't there. And it was just some guy behind the counter. So he had the receiver. He brought it out. There it was. Great. He said, well, anything else? And I said, well, you know, I am going to need a few HDMI cables. And he said, well, what kind? And I didn't really know, since this is my first step into HDMI, because HDMI is not part of recording studios. It's not part of dub stages. It's not part of film sound. It's a home thing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know. So, you know, they had cables there from $20 to $350 mm-hmm. for HDMI cables of the same length. Mm-hmm. And I had no clue. And I didn't know what HDMI 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, 1.4B. I didn't know what any of that stuff meant. And so I said, well, what do you suggest? And he kind of says, well, you know, what do you like? And I didn't know really what he meant, because I really didn't know what the difference was between these different home cables. And I just wanted to buy a good enough cable that it wouldn't be the weakest link in the chain between, you know, my sources, my receiver, and my speakers. You know, I have good speakers, decent speakers, good mic, good speaker cable. Everything else is in good shape. So I said to him, well, here are these two cables. Would you know the difference on your system? And he kind of rolls his eyes and goes, my first question is, would I hear the difference between these two cables? And he said, I have no idea if you'd know the difference. You know, meaning he has no idea if I can hear or not, which is, you know, a valid question.
He doesn't know you.
So I said, well, if you use these cables at your place, would you know the difference? And he says, well, sir, I've invested over $100,000 in my home theater. I'm in an entirely different league than you. At first I thought, well, you know, clearly you didn't go to, you know, salesman school, but that's fine. You know, he works behind the counter at a, you know, home theater shop.
Oh my God.
And it's funny because while that was a really crude thing to say to me, or to say to a customer, you know, kind of looking down at me, it really is in some ways, it's actually a fairly interesting thought. You know, at what point does anybody hear the difference? You know, you could say, well, my iPod is MP3s, which doesn't sound as good as CDs, which doesn't sound as good as vinyl, or doesn't sound as good as, you know, Blu-ray.
96.24.
You know, there's all these levels of consumer sound. And a lot of people would say that digital has gone backwards by going to different compression ratios. Now, I have a DirecTV dish. And DirecTV seems to have a hierarchy of HD and non-HD networks, channels, at different varying resolutions. And I can certainly see the difference because higher compressed shows definitely are more pixelated and blocky, and the motion is less smooth, right?
Right, exactly.
But I can hear some stations definitely are limiting the quality of their broadcast in order to fit into certain bandwidths. A couple of weeks ago, I had a meeting with a network on cable who is planning a. We're in a conversation about creating new music to rebrand the network. And it's a network which currently does not broadcast HD. And I asked them about that, and they said, well, it's very expensive, not only to produce the shows, companies like Dish Network and DirecTV specifically limit certain networks' bandwidth because they have a limited bandwidth anyway just with their satellites. So if you're HBO, you're at the top of the list. And then, you know, if you're... you know, Court TV are sort of at the bottom of the list.
Right.
And then there's everything sort of in between, well, not everything in between, but lots in between.
Sure.
So, you know, the fact is that in the current generation of consumers of audio and video, we are being asked to have very limited expectations. I mean, sure, you know, lots of your viewers have Blu-ray players and have, you know, very high quality electronics to support the format, you know, so that there, again, it's sort of like, where's the weakest link in your chain?
Right.
You know, maybe it's your ears. I don't know. well, that's what that guy was saying to me back at the home theater shop.
Yeah, exactly.
So, actually, I don't know if he was commenting on my ears or on my bad taste in equipment.
Well, you were buying a mid-range Denon receiver, and Denon makes excellent products, and he probably knows that, but first of all, I can't imagine a salesperson at the store spending over $100,000 on a hi-fi system. I mean, come on, even an industry accommodation.
I think he didn't pay $100,000. I think
that's what I mean. Even those of us in the business can often buy stuff from manufacturers at what we call industry accommodation, which is often like dealer cost. But even at dealer cost, and if he works at a dealer, then he's going to get dealer cost on stuff. So. Even at that, you know, $100,000 worth of stuff is going to be $50,000-$60,000. And anybody working at a stereo store is not going to be making the kind of money that they can afford that kind of a system.
I think what you're saying is that he wasn't rude. He was just lying.
He was just lying. The other thing I wanted to make sure everybody listening understands, and I think you and I talked about this before today, is that HDMI cables, as long as they're made reasonably well and the connections are well soldered and the terminator is, you know, well sealed and secured, and it's certified by Simplay Labs, which will certify $20 HDMI cables as long as they meet certain minimum requirements, you don't need to spend that extra money on HDMI cables. It really is a scam in a sense of people trying to convince consumers that spending $350 on an 8-foot HDMI cable is going to give you a better result. It's not. So I want to make sure everybody understands that, and I hope you went with the less expensive cables.
You know, I suppose driving a Bentley and driving a Prius get you to the store.
Exactly, but the same, in exactly the same amount of time.
In the same amount of time, you know, there is a need for certain people to spend certain amounts of money in order to feel good about their purchase. So I think I understand that a $300 and a $30 HDMI cable are effectively the same, but psychologically they're one's 10 times more.
And certainly those people who buy the $300 HDMI cable are going to probably say that they see a difference and hear a difference because they have to justify spending that much money.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the same thing goes with analog cables. And I'm sure this has been an argument that's happened much longer than HDMI. You know, do you spend thousands? You can spend thousands of dollars per foot on audio cable, on analog audio cable.
Sure. Speaker cables come with a certain mythology about silver and oxidizing, and you've written about it, I'm sure, more times than you wish you had.
And you know, I'm sure your studio is cabled with perfectly good cable, as is your home, I'm sure, and I doubt you probably spent thousands of dollars a foot.
I don't think I've spent thousands of dollars. You know, but I will say this, they're in phase.
They're in phase. And that has to be important.
You know, I will say that I did have my studio where I'm sitting now, where I compose. I did have a technician come in when I first moved in to calibrate the room. And he brought in some, you know, real-time analyzing hardware, and he ran very thorough checks of the speakers and recommended a few changes. The two green columns that you're seeing, which are leaning against the, where are they? Okay, that one there.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Those are bass traps.
Mm.
Those were carefully designed and built to absorb low-end frequencies that tend to build up in small to medium-sized spaces, mm-hmm. and also rectangular spaces. I have cork floor. I have carpeting. I have soft fabric against walls. My listening environment has been optimized for accuracy so that when I record and mix right here in my studio translates very well to the rooms where my scores are mixed.
Mm-hmm. And this brings us back to a great little point about accuracy. You mm-hmm. were saying before at the beginning of the podcast that the goal of movie scores is not necessarily to accurately recreate the sound of an orchestra, but I think you would agree here, and this is what you're talking about here, that you want to, whatever you create in your studio, you want it to be accurately reproduced on the dubbing stage, in the commercial cinema, and at home.
Right. And to that end, I have tried out a lot of different things over the years since I started. I spent a few years really struggling with the reproducibility of my mixes in my room, in my studio, into all that matters for me is how my mixes translate to the dub stage. Their job is to do whatever tweaks to make sure that it's going to optimize for theaters or home theaters, whether it's mm-hmm. movies or television, and I work in both.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to know that I have an accuracy across a wide range of speakers in my room. Now, my engineers are really good at this. That is, they have a way of mixing that accounts for very large speakers that have a lot of bass response, a lot of accuracy, and very small speakers that have less accuracy and less bass response.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is, and this is something that's done very much on pop records, is they come up with mixes that sound about as good in the car on Apple earbuds or on higher-end sound systems. So they account for it both in terms of dynamics and bandwidth, you know, low frequency range.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole goal is that whether I'm mixing, I mix some things in my room, some things I mix with my engineer. If it's a full orchestra, I don't usually mix it here. I have a few times. Often I go to my engineer's studio, which is compatible with mine. It's all based on Pro Tools, hardware and software, and others. I use buckets of different things. But we make sure that what we hear when we're mixing sound will translate accurately to the dub stage, where they're going to add the music to effects and dialogue. Now, there the music's going to come down. And when we mix, we actually mix listening to the dialogue, although and some effects, although usually we don't get to hear the effects. But we hear the music relative to dialogue. So, for example, if there's a female voice, we'll stay out of the range of the female voice. If it's a male voice, we try to stay out of the range of the male voice. More often than not, we just try to stay out of the range of the human voice altogether. And stay in more intimate settings, rely on low notes and high notes, and try to carve a little space for that mid-range where the human voice sits. Otherwise, they compete. It's another reason that you tend not to hear a lot of solo instruments in orchestral or in film music, and certainly never during dialogue, or rarely. I shouldn't say never, but often you won't hear it. And especially those solo instruments that sit in that mid-range of the voice, such as a trumpet or saxophone or clarinet, or, you know, those very warm instruments. You might hear an oboe, which is a thinner, slightly more nasal sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might hear a cello, but you tend not to hear too many. We stay out of the solo range because it's distracting.
Mm-hmm.
That's why a lot of film scores tend to have most of the orchestra playing most of the time. It's again brings the emotional level up, but at the same time, it makes it less. It doesn't attract our ear and distract it from the voices and the dialogue, because people come to movies to listen to what people have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Jerry Bruckheimer movies, where they're watching how big things explode.
You mentioned earlier that you use Pro Tools and buckets of other things, and I was going to ask you, how has the audio technology that you use changed over the years? I'm thinking in particular about racks of synthesizers and processors and physical devices now being completely inside the computer.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's nothing. I think it was you who once said to me that the perfect signal path was a short straight wire.
Yes.
And that anything beyond that was going to in some ways degrade the signal. So certainly when I got started in the 90s, there was an enormous amount of analog equipment that was needed in the support of recording and mixing sound.
Mm-hmm.
And with every piece of equipment came another opportunity for hum, buzz, or hiss.
Yep.
And although nobody denies the quality of, you know, classic vintage analog equipment, and in fact there are many engineers still maintain limited racks which they pass their Pro Tools systems through as kind of a loop,
mm-hmm.
In order to get some of the quality that some of this equipment has, the amount of it, and frankly, none of it's needed. It's all been sort of simulated now in software, and simulated extremely well.
So modeled in software, so they might have modeled the sound of a particular compressor or a particular EQ or reverb.
Exactly right. So what's happened is it. It seemed to always be that whether we were recording, mixing, or dubbing, some amount of the time was spent fixing. or setting up. You know, the just the time saved in trying to track down a bad cable or a bad patch cord when there were patch bays being used.
I remember
has
those.
Has been an enormous change. You know, there's still things that go wrong, but now there are digital problems that go wrong. There's sync problems and transfer problems and hard drive problems, but it pales in comparison. You know, the problems of keeping an analog system at that high level functioning is enormous. So we were always dealing with those problems along with time code and synchronization issues and leakage with analog equipment where you would hear something passing between two cables that were too close together and, mm-hmm. and bad grounding and ground loops where somebody's gear was patching somebody else's gear. And then anyway, all that is basically gone now. And that's actually a really, really great thing. You know, you can debate about digital versus analog, and I could not care less. Really what matters is that we are getting closer and closer to the straight wire, the short straight wire. The fact is that not only can an engineer create an extraordinarily high-quality signal path, and it gets better every couple of years, something comes out that is, you know, a little bit of a game. We don't have too many game changers anymore, but, you know, we see the evolution has not slowed down in terms of the quality of sound, the ease of use, the capabilities, and more as important as the practicality. So more time is spent in the execution and less is spent in the chasing down of problems. So we really now have all of our time spent being creative and being careful, to ensure very high quality for the listening experience, both in theaters, television, and, you know, home media of all kinds. Mm-hmm. So it's been an enormous improvement for everybody involved. It's better for us as creators and better for listeners as consumers of any kind of media, whether it's even listening to an MP3. At least it was an MP3 of something that sounded really good.
Yeah, fantastic. On that note, I'm afraid we've run out of time. So I want to thank you, Jeff, for being on the show. It's been a great hour.
It was my pleasure. And I think people see my website, and if they want to, you know, drop in, please feel free to come visit me anytime.
Absolutely. The website Jeff's talking about is jeffrona.com. Very easy to remember.
It's fairly easy to remember. My mom knows it.
And I encourage everybody to go check out Jeff's website, where he's got all kinds of useful information, interesting stuff about his life and career. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, I have two guest geeks scheduled, Gary Shufield and Ray Santilli. These guys are the producers of Alien Autopsy. You might remember that from the Fox network some time ago, purporting to be footage from the 1950s of an alien autopsy. And now they've recently created a documentary, or what they sometimes call a mockumentary, of that film. So we have several meta levels here to discuss with these guys, and they'll be talking with me from England. So I'm really looking forward to that, and I sure hope you join me. Until then, geek out.